You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the relationship between presidents and their vice presidents has changed a lot over time. We'll look at that history, including Joe Biden's choice of Kamala Harris as his running mate. Now, most of the nominees for seats in the state legislature and U.S. House are set after yesterday's primary elections. There were no statewide races on the ballot, but some districts are expected to be competitive and watched closely as state Democrats hope to fend off Republicans from gaining a veto-proof majority in the legislature. In safely Democratic or Republican districts, though, winners yesterday are all but certain to win office in November. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter. Laurel, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the outcome, let's look at what went into it. A lot of attention to the April elections here in Wisconsin during the pandemic. How did things go logistically this time around?
So it looked a bit different than it did in April. I think some of the places that we were watching really closely were Milwaukee and Green Bay. We know that they had some pretty long lines in April because they had fewer polling places than they normally do. Milwaukee in particular only had 5 in April when they have normally around 180. So they had increased those back up to more regular levels for this election. And so we saw kind of smoother sailing in terms of not having those long lines that we saw in April. Clerks had a little bit more time this go around to figure out how they were going to navigate the COVID-19 pandemic and still provide, you know, kind of safe, effective voting locations for folks. So we saw a little bit of the effects of that longer term planning this time around.
And a lot of mail-in voting, I understand. Laurel, is that a precursor of things to come in November?
Absolutely. I think it's an understatement to say that the amount of mail-in ballots this election smashed records. I mean, we're seeing mail-in voting in numbers that we just, I don't think, would have comprehended even a year ago. And that's just going to continue, I think, heading into November. We saw a little bit of a delay in processing those in Milwaukee yesterday. I think they were having some troubles with some machines on processing ballots. But it's kind of uncharted territory at this point. And it's a little bit different than folks going in person and feeding the ballot into the machine. Clerks have to kind of do some more checks on those ballots when they look at them and take them out of their bags on election day. So it's a different process and one that everybody's getting used to, and certainly getting used to in the volume that is currently existing and is expected.
Let's check out a couple of the races and how they're shaking out. We don't have a lot of drama usually with congressional seats here in Wisconsin. Most of them are safe seats, but we've got the 3rd district held by Democrat Ron Kind. What came out of the primaries there, and what are the thoughts looking ahead in November?
So this is considered a swingier district in Wisconsin, one that neither party is taking for granted. So we saw Derek Van Orden won the Republican primary over Jesse Eben in that race. So he's going to go on to face the incumbent Democratic Representative Ron Kind in November, who won his Democratic primary over a challenge from Mark Newman, a name that we've seen in Wisconsin politics before. So,
but a different Mark Newman.
Different Mark Newman, exactly. Not to be confused with the Republican Mark Newman.
Right. But
yeah, so we're going to see a familiar face in Ron Kind on the ballot in November going up against Derek Van Orden.
Then let's turn to a congressional seat where a familiar face will not be on the ballot. Longtime Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner decided he wasn't going to run again in the 5th District in southeastern Wisconsin. This is almost certainly a safe Republican seat, or viewed that way. Talk about the primary there and the likely next congressperson from the district.
So it seems like roughly a million years ago that we were speculating that this was going to be a very crowded Republican primary. This is considered to be a pretty darn safe Republican seat on the spectrum of kind of safe partisan districts in Wisconsin. And this is a seat, as you mentioned, that Jim Sensenbrenner has held for quite a long time, decades. And so something that Wisconsin Republicans have had their eye on and kind of waiting for that opportunity to run for this congressional seat. Back in the day, we thought there was going to be a flood of Republicans kind of stepping forward to take this chance. And that's really not what happened. Essentially, State Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald stepped forward and had a mostly uncontested Republican primary for this seat. He had a challenger, but he came out the victor very handily with more than 75% of the vote yesterday. So Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald seems like he's cruising to a seat in Congress.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about yesterday's primary elections in Wisconsin. Well, Laurel, speaking of longtime lawmakers in pretty much safe seats, State Senator Fred Risser of Madison retiring when his term is up. This is the first time it's been an open seat in, knocking on the door, 6 decades there. So this is another one. It's a safe Democratic seat. What do we see in that race to replace Fred Risser?
So we did see a flood of candidates for this one for a long time, a seat that hadn't been open for a long time. There were 7 candidates in the Democratic primary for this seat, which is seen as a safe Democratic district. And the person that came out on the top of that primary is a name that I think political watchers are probably pretty familiar with. A former state representative in the assembly and a former candidate for governor, Kelda Royce. She actually came in third in the 2018 Democratic primary for governor. So somebody that's been around for a while, and it looks like somebody that's going to be in the state Senate come November.
Any other seats that you'd been keeping your eye on for the primary yesterday, Laurel?
So I think there were a number of other interesting races. There was another 7-way primary for a seat in the Madison area, the assembly seat being vacated by Representative Chris Taylor. I think that one's interesting because the winner of that primary is Francesca Hong. I actually interviewed her earlier today, and she thinks that she would be the first Asian American state lawmaker at the Wisconsin Capitol. It's kind of hard to say those firsts with certainty ever. We're always kind of, a little worried about making that big of a proclamation, but her campaign did a bunch of research, talked to a bunch of scholars, dug through some data, and they can't find evidence of anybody. Of course, there always isn't that demographic of information available for every state lawmaker in history. So we're a little slow to make that proclamation, but it's certainly certainly notable that an Asian American could be heading to the state legislature. In terms of just the demographic representation in the legislature.
Now, the big story for state legislature in Wisconsin in November is the Republican effort. If they can flip a few seats in each chamber, they could have a supermajority, and then they could pretty much call all the shots. They could override vetoes from the governor. How hotly contested is this going to be, Laurel?
So that's a really big deal. I think that's the biggest thing that Republicans and Democrats have their eye on this fall. Republicans only need to pick up 3 more seats in each of the chambers, so 6 seats total, to get that supermajority to override any veto from the governor and take away that really powerful thing that he has in kind of the balance of power. So there are certainly some close districts, places where elections have been tight in those 6 seats that Republicans are looking at, some more than others. So that's really where a lot of Democrats have their eyes kind of in a defensive mode, and where Republicans are hoping to make some gains this fall.
We'll watch those between now and November. Laurel, thanks as always for joining us.
Sure thing.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She talked with us about primary results from yesterday's elections around the state and key races they set up for November. Coming up, there are concerns about the availability and cost of the COVID-19 tests that use a nasal swab. Wisconsin researchers are working on one that tests saliva instead. We'll find out how it can make testing faster, cheaper, and more available. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about Wisconsin research into a new COVID-19 test that could be faster, easier, and cheaper than the nasal swab version. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a victim of the coronavirus, a 28-year-old activist who advocated for youth in the foster care system. He's just one of the 1,000 Wisconsinites who have been killed by COVID-19 as of yesterday.
Doshay DJ Joy really lived up to his name. He posted a video of himself on Facebook, and in it, Joy is giving a speech about some of the pain he experienced as a child in and out of foster homes in Milwaukee, and how he ultimately rose above the darkness.
The one thing you can never take away from me is the joy that I bring to so many people. I have been told by a friend that my smile brings bright light into a very dark room.
Joy's best friend, Teodolo De La Garza, says that was absolutely true.
Our friendship was like the bomb.
The two met at Springfield College in Milwaukee. As counselors, De La Garza says he and Joy challenged each other to be the best versions of themselves.
And he's like, I just want to help you grow in this area. It was always that. And I would say, like, you know what? I'm going to tell you right now, I'm probably not going to like what you're going to say. And if I get mad and I say something back, just know that it's because I'm not accepting what you're saying. But give me a few days and I'll come back and I'll tell you you're right.
Joy loved gospel music and was deeply religious. Recently, he was improving his health by going to the gym. He had a ton of friends and a relationship with his birth mother. De La Garza says Joy was unapologetically himself as a gay man.
And because he was able to just always be himself, I'm like, I don't know how he does it, but I want to do that too.
But advocacy and volunteer work were Joy's life. He taught people their rights, accompanied minors to court, and worked as a substance abuse counselor. Joy pushed to establish a group home for LGBTQ youth in Milwaukee.
He was bold.
Yeah.
That brother was awesome. Like, going the extra mile for people. And some people may have thought that he was doing too much, but in reality, he was just kind-hearted. It was always for the benefit of the community. It was always for the support of clients.
He was always the first to raise his hand and to have a story about the reason why this was really important and why we had to make some changes. So he was an advocate in the best possible way.
Wendy Henderson is the Division of Safety and Permanence Administrator with the Wisconsin Department of Children and Families. She worked with Joy on and off for about 10 years. He would speak on panels for the state and talk with judges or social workers about what it was like to be in out-of-home care.
There's nothing more powerful at a legislative hearing than hearing a young person talk about their own experience, and you take something that's the most traumatic experience of your life and then use that to try to make change in the system. That's a really hard tightrope to walk, and he did that well, and he held other people's hand while they did it.
Joy died of complications from COVID-19 in mid-May after spending about 2 weeks in the hospital.
It's just a tremendous loss, honestly, because I think he could have been a great addition to wherever he decided to put his energy.
Hi, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. to all my friends and family.
Joy took a trip to Washington, D.C. last year with a group of foster youth. While there, he developed a friendship with Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee. They even spent holidays together. After Joy passed, she introduced legislation named in his honor that would allow former foster youth to stay on Medicaid until age 26.
That's his legacy. He wanted to change the laws.
De La Garza says Joy also wanted to pursue his master's degree and eventually open a group home to help youth overcome trauma. De La Garza deeply misses his best friend, and he still texts him. He'll send him updates about his job as an AODA therapist at the Milwaukee LGBT Center.
Let's see. Oh, I was on July 6th. I said, miss you, bro. I'm submitting my background check to the board to become credentialed nationally, like we always talked about. Miss you, bro. Wish me luck.
De La Garza now finds himself asking, what would Doshay do?
I'm still living in what he taught me, you know? Just this time it's by myself now, you know?
Doshay DJ Joy is just one of the 1,000 Wisconsinites who has died from COVID-19 this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This project is a collaboration between WPR News and Wisconsin Life. Find more of these stories at WPR.org. Now, if you've gotten a test for COVID-19, it was probably a swab that was put up your nose. Results may have taken from a couple days to a couple weeks. While the current tests are a good tool, there are concerns about supply shortages and the cost of the tests, and that delays in getting results can hamper efforts to stop community spread of the virus. Researchers, including some here in Wisconsin, are working on a new type of test that would address those concerns using saliva samples instead of the nasal swab. Dave O'Connor is one of those researchers. He's a UW Medical Foundation professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison. His research lab, along with others at the AIDS Vaccine Research Laboratory, studies how viruses cause disease and change over time. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about this new COVID test. How would it work?
Well, first, you need to understand the three different types of tests. There's diagnostic tests, which mean that you're symptomatic, and so you go get a PCR test. There are screening tests, which is what you would get if someone in your house or someone in your workplace was sick, and then everyone in the workplace goes and gets tested. And then there's a third type of test called surveillance test, which is what you would use when you test the same population of people over time to make sure that people who are non-symptomatic stay uninfected. And so the test that we're working on falls into that surveillance test category. So it's designed to be cheap, fast, and easy to use if you need to be tested over and over and over again.
And the thing there is, if we want to say, okay, we want to be able to, you know, make sure our teachers aren't getting sick, say, or whatever the group setting is, we want something that can turn around fast. It's easy to do. People may not want to swab up their nose multiple times a week, right? That's the problem we're trying to solve there.
Right, exactly. So after about 24 hours of waiting for a test result, their test result's going to rapidly diminish in value because people are only going to be contagious for a short window of time, typically beginning about 2 days before they feel symptoms, if they feel symptoms, and continuing for about a day or two after they feel symptoms. And so unless you're very, very lucky, most of the people who are going to get be found to be positive by conventional tests are not actually the people who you want to get to isolate in order to stop transmission. So a test that identifies those people as quickly as possible is really needed.
So where are you in the testing process for this saliva-based test right now?
So we've been testing this in and around the Madison area for the last month or so. We've now tested just about 1,000 volunteers, and it's very straightforward. We have a minivan that contains all of the testing equipment and supplies. So this is a sort of test that can be deployed anywhere. We set up a mobile lab at a particular site. We consent people to participate in our study, have them sign a few forms. Then they self-collect a small amount of saliva just by spitting into a tube. We then heat the tube to inactivate the virus that might be present if they were infected. And then we just add a little bit of the saliva to a chemical mixture. And that chemical mixture changes colors after about a half an hour if there's coronavirus genetic material in the sample. And so we can look to see, did the sample stay pink, which is typically where it starts, or does it turn yellow? And if it turns yellow, then that's an indication that someone might be infected. And because our test is non-diagnostic, what that does is triggers a phone call from a physician to say, you should isolate and go get a diagnostic test as quickly as possible.
Now, it sounds like this is a test, if it really works and it we develop it, it doesn't necessarily need to go through a lab, because is this something that could be like at a work site, and that could be the first test or first part, the early warning system, I guess?
Right. So that's exactly what we're aiming to do with this, is as part of a surveillance network, you could have a fleet of these sorts of testing setups that get deployed to various places. So our initial tests have been at two UW-Madison workplaces, Eagle School in Fitchburg, which is near Madison, and then working with the athletic department at UW-Madison to do early testing of people who are participating in student athletics or coaching staff. And the idea is that you can then expand this to have, instead of central labs that can process thousands or tens of thousands of samples, you have small lab units that each can process about 200 samples a day.
From what you said about the process, it sounds like if we have some false positives, that's not so bad, because the people are going to get hopefully rechecked with a more accurate and time-intensive test. What about false negatives? Is there a risk that if we don't get this right, people could go in with a false sense of security?
Sure, I think that's a risk, but it needs to be measured against the risk of not testing enough people or not having rapid turnaround testing at all. So right now, the CDC estimates that between 80 and 95% of people who are infected never get tested at all. And because of the delays in turnaround time, most people who do get tested and are positive don't find out that they're positive until after they've passed their window of contagiousness. So right now, we're doing a really poor job of finding anyone who's contagious. And so a test like this that might get us 80% of the way there would be quite a bit better than what we have right now.
What would the timeline be from where you are now to where this could be in pretty common use around the state?
Well, so there's a couple of roadblocks. One is that we need to figure out how you basically set up each of these individual sites and get people trained to operate them successfully. And that's one thing that we're working on right now. And we're really working very hard to bring this to as many different places as possible, as quickly as possible. The supply chain issues are real. You mentioned them in the intro. Our supply chain is largely independent from the PCR supply chain, but there still is a global shortage of plasticware, gloves, and other very basic supplies that any kind of testing is going to need. And then a few months down the road, what we're hoping is that in partnership with a local company, Salus Discovery, we hope to have a more professional and robust embodiment with an actual fleet of vans and mobile testing units that can be deployed nationwide. And with the support of an NIH-funded grant, we've been working very hard to try to make that a reality.
Dave, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dave O'Connor is a UW Medical Foundation professor of pathology and laboratory medicine at UW-Madison. He's with us today to share details of a new type of COVID-19 test he's working on. It's being researched here in Wisconsin, aiming to provide a lot more and a lot faster screening for COVID-19. Coming up, the selection of a vice presidential candidate has changed a lot over the years. We'll find out why the old rules don't apply and what it means for running mates in the 21st century. And we'll find out how Mike Pence and Kamala Harris fit in with historical trends. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Milwaukee has been the hardest-hit community in Wisconsin during the coronavirus pandemic. Kate Archer-Kent talks to the city health commissioner about the latest efforts to contain the disease. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, presumptive Democratic candidate for President Joe Biden announced yesterday that Senator Kamala Harris is his pick as his running mate. A lot goes into the choice of a running mate, but the decision has changed over time a lot. Our next guest says we've gone from a balancing act to a compatibility test. Elaine Kmark is a Brookings Institution senior fellow and American politics expert. She's written a number of books, including her most recent, Picking the Vice President. Elaine, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we dig into the history, let's start with the latest news. How does the choice of Senator Harris as Joe Biden's running mate fit into this long story of vice presidential candidates?
Very simply, she was the most qualified person that Joe Biden could have picked. She had the experience of running for president, so she understands what a national campaign is like. She was a very experienced prosecutor and attorney general in the biggest state in the union, a state that's so big, California, that it's bigger than most of the countries in the world. So that was no small job. And she's been in the United States Senate, where she picked up a background in intelligence and military and foreign affairs, which, of course, these days is absolutely critical to the job of president. So that she is quite, she's a woman, even though she's a woman of color, frankly, that's not what's most important here. What's most important is she is well equipped to run for office with Biden, and she's well equipped to take over if need be.
All right, let's take it back to the beginning. And we had an interesting system to start the country off. You write in the book, you ran for president. If you're first place, you're president. If you're second place, you're vice president. So if we had that system in 2016, we'd have President Trump and Vice President Hillary Clinton. I can't see any possible downside there, Elaine. Can you?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that was a fairly ridiculous system. The founding fathers, who were right about so many things, had one blind spot. They naively thought that they could avoid having political parties. And frankly, democracies just don't function without political parties. And so once George Washington, who was, you know, everybody's founding father, once George Washington retired from the presidency, they discovered that there were very different points of view among the political class and among the voters, and that, frankly, having a president from one party and a vice president from the other party didn't work so well. Thomas Jefferson spent his vice presidency under John Adams basically campaigning against John Adams. And sure enough, in 1800, he was elected president himself. So quickly, the founding generation got rid of that one. And ever since about the 1830s, we've had presidents and vice presidents on the same ticket.
And a lot of that time, most of that time, really, up until fairly recently, you write that the ticket, the president, vice presidential ticket, was an arranged marriage, and it was a balancing act in many ways. Tell us what that looked like.
Well, for most of American history, we nominated, the political parties nominated their president in a convention. And the convention was not staffed by people who were coming there as a result of primaries in their state. Those conventions were totally of superdelegates, as we would now call it. They were party leaders and elected officials. And of course, in the days when communication was difficult, you often didn't even know how strong the various candidates were until the delegates actually met in the convention city. And so most conventions had some element of negotiation going on in them. And it was quite exciting, frankly, in the days of radio. Families gathered around the radio to hear the reports from the hall and stuff like that. So there was plenty of excitement. But if you think about those conventions as being essentially gigantic bargaining conventions, what was the biggest bargaining chip anybody had to give? The vice presidency. So what would happen is, a lot of times, you know, if the leading candidate was a couple hundred votes short of delegates, they would offer it to somebody who offered the vice presidency to someone who could put them over the top. What that meant was that there were a lot of arranged marriages, few love matches, lots of arranged marriages. And often the presidents and vice presidents didn't see eye to eye on things. And we have a history, in fact, of vice presidents who spent their time in office undermining the president that they worked for, which is sort of unheard of today.
Yeah, you would end up with these candidates, not just bringing different people, but representing completely different factions of the same party, right? So they were maybe not to the extent of Jefferson Adams, they were still at odds with each other.
Oh, absolutely. There were several pairs notably at odds with each other.
We're talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. She's written a new book, Picking the Vice President. We're talking about how the role of the vice president has changed and how the selection of a running mate has changed over the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thought about the running mates this time around, or whether it matters who the vice presidential candidate is to you. And Elaine, the balancing thing, I think even after the smoke-filled rooms, there's still this thought like, okay, well, if we've got a candidate from out east, we better get somebody from, I don't know, down south or out west or something to balance the ticket. That geographical balancing, how common was that? And did it actually make a difference?
Well, it turns out that in the modern era, the vice presidential pick doesn't really make a difference unless there's a problem with it, unless it blows up on the presidential candidate. And balancing, especially geographically, has really gone out of fashion. And in fact, what I write about in the book is that we've replaced the balancing model with the partnership model. Mm-hmm. So these days, presidential candidates tend to look for a vice president who can do no harm in the election, for sure, but who can help them govern once in office. So if you look at Biden himself, right, he was from the state of Delaware. Delaware is a pretty reliably Democratic state, and it has only 3 electoral college votes. So there was absolutely no point in Barack Obama putting Joe Biden on to win the state of Delaware. Barack Obama saw in Joe Biden somebody who had some of the experiences that he needed and who had deep roots in the Congress and could help him with those negotiations, which Biden did extremely well. So, you know, it's a changed model. And the model, we've now seen this model work with 2 Democratic and 2 Republican presidencies. Clinton chose Gore, which was very much, I mean, Clinton chose Gore. In choosing Gore, he chose somebody just like him, another Southern moderate baby boomer. Then we had Bush choose Cheney. Both of them, let's face it, were Texas oil men. Okay, they had very similar backgrounds, except that Cheney was older and somewhat more experienced. Obama chose Biden. And Trump chose Pence. Again, Pence did, you know, Indiana is a pretty reliably Republican state. Trump didn't need to choose Pence for that reason. And Pence did have that depth of experience in governing that, of course, Trump needed.
And this was
we've got a new pattern here in American politics.
And this is a huge change, not just in the selection of the running mate, but in the job of the vice president. You write, where once upon a time it was like, yeah, you go to the funeral, and that's the job of the vice president.
Right.
And now they really have a job to do now, right?
Yeah, and it's really a remarkable change, but it comes from the fact that once you stop engaging in arranged marriages, right, as I write, you can go to a love match. And you can pick somebody that is like you and who is ideologically like you. And if you pick someone that is similar to your worldview, then guess what? You can trust them with all sorts of tasks that help make the job easier. And you can give them important things to do. So our 4 recent vice presidents have all been right at the center of the action. Including Vice President Pence, who is now leading the coronavirus task force. And that's quite a contrast to previous vice presidents, many of whom, like Lyndon Johnson, were extraordinarily talented and experienced public servants, but they were sidelined by the presidents that they served.
We're talking to Elaine Kmark, Brookings Institution Senior Fellow and American Politics Expert. Her most recent book is Picking the Vice President. We're talking about the history of that office, how it's changed, and the choice of Kamala Harris as Joe Biden's running mate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does the vice presidential candidate influence your vote? Has it ever? Is there a vice president that stands out to you for better or worse? What do you think of Joe Biden's choice of Kamala Harris? How about the role of Vice President Mike Pence in the White House and in elections? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the history of the office of vice president and of running mates and Vice President Joe Biden's choice of California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. Elaine Kmark is with us, Brookings Institution Senior Fellow and American Politics Expert. She has a recent book, Picking the Vice President. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there vice presidential candidates in history that stand out to you as really good or really bad ones? What do you think about the working relationships you've seen between presidents and their vice presidents over the years? Do you have a question for our guest who's been thinking about this stuff a lot? Call ahead at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls right now. Luther is with us in Green Bay. Luther, hello.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Luther?
Well, I was just wanting to make an observation, my personal observation, I guess, looking at the past 2 presidential or vice presidential nominees, Biden and now Kamala Harris, that they're kind of maybe handpicked to fill a gap in the demographic of the voters. Kamala Harris this time is kind of the opposite of Joe Biden, as Joe Biden was of President Obama. She is female and a person of color, and Joe Biden playing to President Obama was kind of getting into the different demographic as well. So kind of filling a spectrum.
Luther, thanks a lot for the call. Elaine, what do you think? Some demographic balancing, whether intentional or not, for the Democrats?
Yeah, I think the caller's on to something. I think there was definitely some demographic balancing in both instances. And I think that Biden signaled that early on when he said he would definitely be choosing a woman to be on the ticket. And I think that within that choice, however, it was very clear as various women were vetted that the ability to take over the job and the ability to help govern became the most important criterion among the women that he was looking at. And I think that's why we ended up with Harris, as opposed to some of the other women, many of whom were very talented and will probably go places in politics, but just hadn't had enough seasoning to do the job as it's conceived of today.
Thanks for that call, Luther. I wanted to bring up the choice of former Governor Mike Pence as Donald Trump's running mate, white evangelical voters, key to Donald Trump's success in 2016, key to his hopes for success in 2020. And some people saw Mike Pence as a choice that was a message to those voters. Whether you know much about Donald Trump, here's one of your people running with him.
I think that was completely true. I mean, it was absolutely that he filled that. But remember, Pence also had great depth in governing. He was in the Congress for a long time, and then he was governor of the state. So as important as the message was to the evangelicals, he was also a person that Trump needed to help him govern, perhaps more than any other recent president, because Trump had never held public office. So once again, the balancing, there is still balancing in these choices, but when it comes down to it, it is all about whether or not a person can actually do the job.
Let's go back to our callers. Steve is with us now in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi.
Hi. I'm close to 50 years old, and I don't know how many elections that would have been involved in, but the most controversial, or the one VP that just stands out among all others in my lifetime, is without a doubt Sarah Palin.
Yep.
The other ones, they're a dime a dozen. And
yep.
The way she was treated by the mainstream media, mainly on the left, was just unconscionable. Do you see that same thing happening with this current pick?
And funny you should mention that, Steve, before you answer, Elaine, I see in the news Sarah Palin today offering advice and congratulations to Kamala Harris,
right,
being a woman in that same position. Sorry, Elaine, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And I watched Sarah Palin the other day talking about the challenges that women face. Listen, Sarah Palin got a tough treatment by the press, and I actually expect that Kamala Harris will find the same thing, that she'll get a tough treatment from obviously the Republicans, but also from reporters. There's always this tendency to, you know, they love you for about 36 hours and then, uh-oh, you know, you come under scrutiny, your husband comes under scrutiny. Remember, Sarah Palin's family came under great scrutiny. I think there's one big difference, though, which is that Sarah Palin had two pieces to her vice presidency. In the first several weeks, she was one of the best political talents anybody had ever seen. She definitely reminded me of a female Ronald Reagan. Her convention speech was great. Her campaign demeanor was great. When she got to the point where she had to do one-on-one interviews that were substantive, she fell down on the job. It was clear that she had not had the same kind of background and seasoning that a lot of people aspiring to the presidency or a heartbeat away from the presidency have. And so I think that hurt her a great deal. And I think that Biden and subsequent presidential candidates, too, have been very conscious not to make what they call the Palin mistake. Don't put somebody up there who is so untutored in American politics that they can't, you know, talk about the Federal Reserve Board comfortably or talk about all the complicated things that a president has to deal with comfortably. So I think that she was both, she did get a very rough treatment. On the other hand, she is also a cautionary tale to future presidential candidates about picking a vice president.
Thanks for bringing that up, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. She has a new book, Picking the Vice President, talking about picking the vice president. Let's go back to your calls now. Dan is with us in De Pere. Dan, hello.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. When I was a little kid, I remember Spiro Agnew with Nixon, and everybody thought he was a disaster, all-around disaster. And then I also remember when Mondale picked Geraldine Ferraro. He thought that would balance the ticket, but he only carried one state out of 50. So it's interesting that the balance of the ticket doesn't always work. So thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call, Danny. Hits a couple of interesting cases there, Elaine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Spiro Agnew was a poor pick, and as you remember, he had to resign from office because he was caught literally taking bags of cash in the White House in bribes. So he didn't work out so well. And Geraldine Ferraro, they did not do as complete a vet as they should have done. It was clear that her husband had some really questionable legal and business practices. And the fact that they didn't catch them and it blew up in their faces meant that from then on, the vetting process got a lot more serious in both parties, because that was another cautionary tale. Mondale didn't do so well. On the other hand, Mondale had an awful lot of problems anyway. Reagan was enormously popular in 1984. And so how much damage she caused is not clear. But you know, both Ferraro, Palin, what they point to is that vice presidents can be a problem, and you got to be very careful about it, especially if the candidate is older. And so I would contrast for you all George Bush's pick of Dan Quayle and John McCain's pick of Sarah Palin. Dan Quayle was also thought, like Sarah Palin, to be kind of a lightweight and not that bright and not really ready to be president. And yet, when George Bush put him on the ticket, George Bush was 62 years old and in very, very good health. And as we know, George Bush, bless his heart, lived into his 90s. When John McCain put Palin on the ticket, he was 72 years old. And he had already had a history of cancer. So like Biden, the situation was that we had a presidential candidate who, you know, maybe would not be president for a full term. And so that makes the ability of the vice president to step into the office seamlessly all the more important. If the presidential candidate is sort of younger and vigorous, you know, okay, then the vice president will take some flack, but it's not that costly. If the presidential candidate is older, then the vice presidency simply matters more.
Elaine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Elaine Kmark is a Brookings Institution Senior Fellow and American politics expert. Her most recent book is Picking the Vice President. She was with us to talk about the history of the office and Joe Biden's choice of Kamala Harris as his running mate. Still time for you to share your thoughts on whether the running mate matters to you this year or in years past. Do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Big Ten will not play ball this fall. Other college athletic conferences are following their lead or thinking about it. We'll look at the tough decisions in college sports and what they mean for athletes, campuses, and fans. And groups of moms are getting involved in protests and politics as moms. We'll look at the history of activism by organized groups of mothers in the United States. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, police officers are often the first responders for mental health emergencies, but there have been calls for another kind of emergency response. Kate and her guests look at one city's effort to bring trained mental health workers into the mix. Find out more tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out why a beach on Milwaukee's Lake Michigan shoreline has been made into one of the most accessible beaches, maybe the most accessible beach in the whole country. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.